Okay, thank you. So I would start by saying it's great to be after Natalia because she already gave a great introduction. It's not great to be after Natalia because she already gave you the great introduction. So you can sleep the first 10 minutes and I will wake you up when it gets interesting. So the LDMX experiment, in a nutshell, that's a slide summarizing basically what I'm going to tell you. LDMX stands for Light Dark Matter Experiment. So no fancy name. We spent, I guess, a good minute thinking about it, and we settled for that. And it's basically a new proposal aimed at exploring sub-GV BSM physics with really unprecedented sensitivity. The experiment uses a missing momentum technique. Natalia already alluded to that. To search for particles basically coupling to electrons. And we really focus on invisible or displaced decays. So we can think of this experiment like an ultra-short baseline beam dump. And we would start out this technique as really great sensitivity to a broad array of physics. We first focused really on light dark matter, but you can also look for new force carriers, mid-charged particles, axion long-lived particles, and Asher already gave a few examples this morning. I'll tell you a few more, and I'm gonna just go through the list. It turned out LDMX could also perform some useful measurements for neutrino physics. We haven't really done that much research in that sector, so I'm going to just flash you a slide, but that's also an avenue. This experiment will require a multi-GV low current high repetition beam, and there are two potential candidates right now, sorry, Dazel and Sebaf. And we are performing ongoing studies to optimize the detector technology and the layout. So let's go. So I guess I don't need to remind you about thermal dark matter. I think it's still a very compelling paradox, and the division between the WIMP region, the WIMP realm, and the light dark matter region. And if you're not very familiar with that, it turns out that if you look at freeze-out scenario with a light dark matter, it would require a new mediator to explain the atomic density. And among the simplest possibilities, you want something that's neutral under the standard model and renormalizable. You could have a new scalar that couples with the X, the phi, or a new vector A prime with coupling to the photon. So we already have seen that in many talks. The dark matter mediator mass also determines the type of annihilation, and it's gonna work. If the dark matter mass is greater than the mediator mass, you basically, your dark matter basically annihilates into a pair of mediator. If that's the case, you will annihilate into a pair of standard model particles. That's what we call direct annihilation. Those guys can later on decay to standard model particles. So we'll see in a minute that for that case, you get a fairly wide parameter space with no specific targets. That's still variable for scalar and vector mediator. For that case, as Natalia mentioned, you have very well-defined targets. That are already ruled out for a scalar mediator. And in this talk, I'm going to really focus on direct annihilation invisible decays after a little detour on the secluded sector. So secluded decay, what's it called, the WIMP next door. I got aware of that recent paper not so long ago. They basically consider the case in which dark matter standard model coupling is large enough to keep the two sectors in thermal equilibrium. And if you do that, you end up with a minimal, somewhat UV-insensitive cosmological dark matter history. That implies basically a minimum dark matter standard model coupling. And that model is called, quite imaginatively, a WIMP next door. And so I got to look at the paper, and I will admit it was fairly late, so my eyes were glazing the paper. I first looked at hidden sector dark matter. Oh, great, a region there. Jumping to epsilon 10 to minus 6, 7, and then jumping to the mass, 1000. And in my mind, you know, light dark matter connects to MeV, MeV, light dark matter. So I thought, hey, great, we can really explore a lot of stuff. And then I came back to the paper and I saw GeV and kind of a little bit of a bummer. So it turns out that LDMX type of experiment could only explore a tiny fraction of that parameter space. And in a state of the scalar mediator, you have only significant coupling in the small mass range between the electron and the muon mass for the scalar mediator. So I'm not going to discuss that anymore, but we're going to focus on the direct annihilation case with a vector mediator. And that essentially that scenario. Dark matter annihilates into an A prime that mixes to a photon, decaying to standard model particles. And if you write the thermodynamic cross section, you end up with an expression that is basically 1 over max dark matter square multiplied by this dimensionless variable, this y that has this expression. And so you end up with very definitive predictions as a function of the mass and the particle type. And you can see on that plot that the prediction for different type of dark matter, the solid black line, and those are a few constraints, existing constraints. So for some of these measurements, when you want to recast them on that plot, since you have to do some assumption on alpha dark and the ratio of the mediator, we cherry-picked some of the parameters. But contrary to most of the people who cherry-pick to look the best they can, we cherry-pick to look the worst we can. And so these dashed regions are really the weakest constraint you can get in that type of model. If I crank up alpha dark, or if I crank up the mass ratio, or some of these constraints move down, but these lines, they don't move. So we are basically sitting in a corner where what's kind of the worst case scenario dark matter could be, and we want to be sure we can exclude that. The next slide shows a few constraints from cosmology, and it turns out that cosmological constraints are already ruling out Dirac fermion dark matter because it proceeds via S-wave annihilation. Natalia already told us that. And that essentially leaves us with scalar Majorana and pseudo-Dirac dark matter. Oopsie, come on. So we already saw that plot two. That's the elastic cross-section. And you see in case of the elastic scalar, the direct detection limits are currently a little bit above the predictions, but the next generation of experiment could really explore the elastic scalar case. But you see that the Majorana case is suppressed by velocity square, and since velocity is like 10 to minus 3, boom, you pay a 10 to minus 6 penalty right off the bat. Even worse, for inelastic dark matter, you have to proceed at two interactions, so it's kind of epsilon to the fourth, and that drives you down over there. Now, I'm a fairly optimistic guy in life, but when I see, you know, 10 to 20 orders of magnitude to go there, my first reaction is, yeah, good luck with that one. So the way to kind of solve that problem is to go to accelerator, as Natalia already mentioned. Simply because since now the velocity is close to one, you don't have this penalty of V square, and you can produce a pair of inelastic dark matter, so you don't have the two interactions. And that bring all these lines to a neat three lines almost together, separated by like 2 to 3 orders of magnitude. And so the main point I'm gonna make about that talk is not that you can probe dark matter. Is that you can robustly probe dark matter trying the different dark matter nature combinations. That's really the great advantage of accelerators. And as I said before, and we'll say even after, that's just one aspect of the experiment, sensitive to a few host of other things. And I guess in essence, that's basically exploring physics that couples two electrons in a sub-JV regime, which I think is very well motivated, and that could be very interesting. So how to do that? We have also already seen that you get essentially three techniques, missing energy, missing momentum, on the top left, where you basically simply radiate your A prime that will decay to a pair of dark matter particles, and that's it. Your signal is essentially a single recoiling electron. Beam dump, same kind of production, but that you detect dark matter in the detector. And finally, missing mass, where you produce your A prime on shell by emitting a photon. So at low masses, turn out that process is much slower than that one if you are far off shell, and at higher masses, if you are close to the center of mass energy of the E plus E minus, that process tends to be better. So we focused on light dark matter. And I know that that process not only maximizes the production yield, but you also somewhat maximize your detection yield because you don't pay this additional epsilon squared price to detect the particle. So that's essentially what the missing energy momentum is about. I should also stress that there is some complementarity with the detection, because you would like, if you see something very much DD, to see something too, to kind of establish the cosmological stability of dark matter. So it's not really an exclusion. The kinematics is also fairly interesting, this process, because it's a little bit counterintuitive. It's really different from Bremsstrahlung emission, because this A prime is now massive. And so you end up with basically having the recoil electron with a low energy. It's soft. Most of the energy is taken by the A prime. So this guy is soft and recoils at a fairly wide angle. And you can see on that plot the recoiling electron energy from Bremsstrahlung and for typical signal. And you see a fairly big difference over there. A few words on missing energy and missing momentum. What's the difference between those? Well, missing energy, you just have some electron plus missing energy. Missing momentum, you also measure the momentum of the electron. So you tend to have a bit of a higher signal yield in that case, the missing energy, greater acceptance, but you start running into trouble with backgrounds at 10 to the 14 electron on targets. And you might require some electron or photon identification. In that case, you reconstruct the electron, so you have a little bit less acceptance, but the PT spectrum is sensitive to the ratio MA prime over MX, so that gives you extra information. And of course, if you just simply ignore information in a tracker, a missing momentum is just a missing energy experiment. So how to successfully do that? Well, you first want a beam that allows you to individually tag each incident electron, because you might want to see that it's scattered. So the idea is to have, the ideal would be a multi-GeV, low current, high repetition beam. So you get one electron at a time every few nanoseconds, and fairly high repetition because you don't want to wait 15 years before you get your experiment. And you also want to fairly wide beam spots to avoid irradiating always the same area in the tracking in the detector. And there are currently two potential candidates for that. One is called Dazzle at SLAC. I'm going to have a slide or two on that. And the other would be SEBAF at JLab as another possibility. As far as detector goes, to match the beam requirements, you want something fast. At a fairly low mass, so don't have many multiple scattering. And you want to see a very fast, granular, and radiation-hard calorimeter. Otherwise, it's going to die after a few years. And so the LDMX proposal has been proposed to realize these design requirements in two phases. Phase one, with 10 to 14 EOT, so roughly one electron every 25 nanoseconds on target. And a phase two with 10 to 16 EOT, cranking up the rate by a factor of 10 to achieve the required statistics. Dazzle, I don't know if you are very familiar with SLAC and the SLAC coherent light source. That's basically this LCLS accelerator, and they provide an X-ray photon beam to some experiment. And the idea is, we'll see in a minute, to basically build a transfer line between that LCLS line and some experimental area. So what's happening with LCLS? Turns out that the system and the accelerator that feeds LCLS runs basically at 180 megahertz. But the experiment, so that's the soft X-ray FEL stands for free electron laser, and the hard X-ray, they basically want something at a level of 1 megahertz. So you are left with all these unused buckets of electrons. And the idea is to excite and divert all these red little buckets into this Dazzle beam line and transfer them to end station A. That's really a completely parasitic system. And the end user on that side wouldn't see anything. And you would just recover the unused bunches. That's in essence the Dazzle proposal. A few words about the LDMX detector concept. That's for phase one. You see three, namely three pieces, the big magnet surrounding the tracking system and the target, and a set of two calorimeters, an E-cal and an H-cal. The detector design is basically driven by the type of backgrounds you need to reject. So you get the trivial background, electron is coming in and getting out, crashing in the E-cal. Then you get some hard Bremsstrahlung, you want to avoid those. And then you go into the deeper into rare and rare reactions, where you have basically photonuclear reactions. These hard photon producing hadrons, a pair of muons, and then you get exclusive reactions, for example, gamma N to three neutrons, so on and so forth. Turns out that some irreducible neutrino backgrounds are much less than 10 to the minus 16, so we are safe from that. And our goal is really to eliminate all those and keep that type of signal. So first, the tracking system. Tracking system is composed of two subsystems, a tagging tracker, you can see over there, and a recoil tracker, and the target is just right over there. And if you can see the target, you don't need to get your eyes checked at the doctor for the next few weeks. That's two low mass, very fast trackers, 2 nanosecond heat time. They are really radiation hard. And the goal is to make sure that you get a full energy incoming electron for GeV. And then if you get some reaction, produce some dark matter, that electron will recoil with much lower energy, between 50 and 200 MeV. So the goal of that tracking system is to make sure that a 4 GeV is incoming and a 1.2 GeV is outgoing. The target is a thin tungsten target to basically strike a balance between producing enough signal and avoiding to degrade the momentum resolution by too much. And that, in a sense, some of the simulation we have performed that shows that everything works, that what if you shoot a 4 GeV in and that what you reconstruct, and that if you shoot an off-target 1.2 GeV electron in, and you want to make sure that it doesn't reconstruct at the 4 GeV. So you imagine some beam background that has a 1.2 GeV electron, and if you miss completely that and it just appears there, you would say, oh, I have a 1.2 GeV that scattered, that might be signal. But since you don't reconstruct it as an incoming 4 GeV electron, you are safe on that side. The EM calorimeter, it's a silicon tungsten sampling calorimeter. It's very fast, very dense, and very radiation hard. We plan to use 40 interaction lengths, that's a big number, but you really want to contain the Boole shower. And it's very granular, so you can exploit the information on how the shower propagates and can also provide a fast trigger. We use basically this technology because it's currently developed for the CMS upgrade, the front E-cal. And so that's kind of readily adaptable to LDMX. And you see, for example, that the high granularity allows you to separate electrons, a signal versus a photon, for example, decay, converting to a pair of muons. Oh, too far away. That plot is a plot we produced already quite a few months ago, and it shows that if you shoot a 4 GeV electron inside your calorimeter and you check how much energy you reconstruct, you never reconstruct below 1.2 GeV electron, which will be essentially your signal region, at the level at least of 10 to minus 13, 10 to minus 14. Since then, we have made a lot of progress. We have used the smarter classifiers and made a lot of improvements, and we can even do better. But even with a simple analysis, you can already reject all your trivial background at the level of 10 to minus 13, 14. Finally, we have a fairly big atomic calorimeter at the back. It's essentially a huge sandwich of steel and plastic. You just do sampling calorimeter. And the idea is to surround the ECAL as much as possible to catch PNO reactions that the ECAL wouldn't catch. And the typical example is, if I go back, typical example is that your photon produces a photonuclear reaction, producing a bunch of energetic neutrons. The ECAL is not gonna see them, so you need a fairly big H-scal to catch and tag those guys. And the design is still under study, exactly what the best layout and the parameters, but it looks like something by a few meters wide and deep should do the job. What on the trigger? The idea is we can't keep all events, of course. So we have two triggers. One, a few PVTs or plastic scintillator just right behind the target that tells you if there is something happening or not. And then we can essentially use the ECAL, the first layer of the ECAL, to see if there is an interaction, a trail interaction or not. And you see that, so it's fairly difficult to see, but that's already also a very preliminary study on an old plot. But for the A' mass between 1 and 1,000 MeV, we already achieve an efficiency that's above 50% to almost 100%. And that has gotten much better since. So we can trigger that experiment. And that type of trigger gives you roughly a 10 to minus 4 background rejection, which will be enough to perform the experiment. One interesting thing we encountered during estimating all these backgrounds is how to deal with GeonFort, because you have to model everything, and the interactions as modeled with GeonFort suffer quite a few uncertainties. We were doing initial studies and looking at some events that were not vetoed. Turned out that this type of events had very peculiar topology where the forward momentum of some of the backward momentum on some of the nucleus produced was very high. Turned out that this type of event are not really tuned to data in the regime. And there are a few predictions made by Geon that seems to be fairly far away from what some measurements predict. So we also spent some time trying to tune a little bit better Geon and to validate all the simulation. Sensitivity estimate, so once you fold all that with our pretty recent plots, the blue band shows the estimate for LDMX phase one for different type of dark matter, and the red band shows the reach for phase two. So you see that phase one, you can already exclude, or at least probe, I would say, most of the targets below 100-ish of MeV. And phase two, you can really nail it down to 200-300 MeV at least. That's really sensitivity far beyond what all of the other experiments planned or currently running can achieve. As Natalia already mentioned and Asha this morning, that's not the only thing LDMX can do. And I just tried to collect a few sample scenarios where LDMX would be able to say something. I have to warn you, some of the plots are a bit old because they're the only ones I found with the LDMX curve not drawn by hand. So for example, asymmetric dark matter or ELDER, you see predictions here and there, can also be probed by LDMX. Invisible mediator decays, and some of the scenarios Natalia outlined, let's see, tremendous improvements. Midi charged particles, and that's a recent paper by Kraniak, Berlin, Asher is on here, I guess, Hooper, McDermott. So it turned out that this specific model is already excluded, the specific edges int is already excluded by E137, so it's not entirely relevant, but what is more relevant is the fact that you see LDMX can really improve the type of sensitivity by quite a few orders of magnitude. And strongly interactive massing particles, displaced vertices. Asher picked one of those plots this morning. I tend to pick one where LDMX has a much better line. One thing that I mentioned is that we can also provide some useful electronuclear and photonuclear measurements for neutrino experiments. And you can see, for example, that this plot shows the data of electron scattering over carbon nuclei, I guess. Yes, carbon. And you see various Monte Carlo predictions don't describe very well the data. And so they need this type of data to tune their Monte Carlo when they perform experiments like Dune and others. And so LDMX being essentially a small, you know, you can think about it as a small fixed target experiment, we could perform some of those measurements that will help improve the simulation for neutrino experiments. One slide on LDMX mu. It's basically the same idea, but instead of using an electron beam, you use a muon beam. And you can probe some models where you have a new light muonphilic particle, and you see once again that would be the sensitivity you would reach, or muonphilic dark mediator, once again improving. That's our people. I guess I have to show that. I was very proud that I found a way in PowerPoint to put a little dot over the A. Actually, Torsten told me that, that this makes this thing absolutely insane, because in Swedish, sometimes they put double A, sometimes they don't put the thing. So when he goes to the airport and then a security clearance, they start asking him, one, the name on his passport doesn't match the name on the ticket, and he has to explain everybody how Swedish works. So that seems to be something interesting. And that essentially my takeaway message. I'm not going to repeat all of that. But one point I want to stress, that we are currently writing a white paper describing the physics and the detector concepts. And we hope to be ready for publication in the coming months, hopefully next month or the one after. So stay tuned and watch archive if you are interested more on LDMX. That's it.
Thanks very much, Benjan. We have plenty much time.
Hi. For the milli charged particles, like, how does it compare to millikan reach?
Do you know?
Honestly, I have no idea. I haven't seen any plot, I guess, on that one.
Any plot? So, millikan is generally focused. Well, first thing that's worth saying is that this particular plot is actually not relying on the millicharge production mode in LDMX. It's relying on the vector portal production mode, although LDMX should be sensitive to both. It just hasn't been calculated in print yet.
Yeah.
But in general, millikan is looking at somewhat larger millicharges and larger masses relative to what the slack millicharge experiment has done. And what LDMX can do is basically go down in coupling relative to slack millicharge and comparable masses.
Yeah, I guess it's a good time to do some advertisement. Let me go back. So that's essentially our detector, and that's roughly going to be, you know, a few meters long. So if you have models and you're doing writing a paper, might be nice if you would to include predictions for LDMX as well, and we can provide you with more detailed dimensions and technical description of the detector. There is a lot of BSM physics scenarios that we have been thinking about, or some people just told us about. There is just not that many predictions that have been made so far. So we are in the process of really working that and trying to come up with solid predictions for more models. I'm just going to take some time.
Okay, I have a question. So if I just look at some constraint plots, It seems there are always a little window, like at like about two, twice a mirror mass, which you need some BR2 input to close. Like, is there any, let's say, like some pasta here? Is there any possibility, like optimistic assumption, like?
I guess we think we have, I wouldn't say not. We have fairly realistic assumptions. Of course, every time you do this exercise, your first try is always a little bit optimistic. And once you get the real simulation and the real life kick in, these curves tend to go up a little bit. But we don't expect, you know, a huge increase. So that's the thing. The other thing is that if you were to run with beams that have higher energy, so I failed to mention that GameX phase one, we think we're going to run at 4 GeV, in phase two, go to 8 GeV, because it's going to be an upgrade of LCLS to 8 GeV. If you get a beam that would be, let's say, double of that, 16 GeV, you would also push these curves a little bit to the right. That's also a way to try to get there. But the other thing is you see that Bell 2 is also coming into play. And these curves are still, and Jan can certainly talk about that better than I, have still been made in a hurry, so they might not be that accurate, and they think they can do, I guess, a bit better and push that down too. No pressure again.
I just... just to mention that you mentioned about these thermal relic contours and picking on the conservative one. In the invisible decay scenario, when you do have resonant annihilation, you can actually push those contours down, you know, four orders of magnitude very easily. So, for example, if the A prime is within 10% of the double the mass of the dark matter, the resonant effect is enormous, and so you can actually move those thermal relic contours down by, I don't know, 4 or 6 orders of magnitude.
Yeah, it's true. So we do that for 3, and then if you crank up, that doesn't really change. But if you go near 2, that can be a bad spot to be.
Yeah.
I just hope that nature has been kind enough to steer us away from that, you know, bad land.
Right. Let's thank Ben Chen again.